very much. And I think we won't have a break now, and we'll get on with our next share. So thank you, Tom.
Thank you. Hello.
Hi, Jim.
Oh.
So, is Hind Street your...
Yeah.
Home group?
Yeah, it is.
Oh, okay.
Although cool. I live in Beckenham, but it's...
Yeah, okay. All righty. Well, I'd now like to introduce Jim S. from Hind Street, his home group, Hind Street in London. And who was the first old-timer you can remember coming across?
The first old-timer I came across, my first meeting was in 1969, a place called Sevenoaks in Kent. And there was a guy there called Big John M. And he was a member of the General Service Board, I found out later. But the message was carried to me by a non-alcoholic, a doctor in Oxford. It was, can I just share
you
that?
You just start sharing
Yeah,
okay.
It's, I'm Jim, I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everyone. Somebody once said it the other way around, and it's not to be special and different, but I'm an alcoholic and my name is Jim, because once I know what I am, I can begin the journey of discovering who I am. And I'm still on that journey, and this is my 40th year in recovery. God willing, I'll be 40 years, October the 27th, 1976. And
great.
Yeah, and this year is kind of, I'm making a year of it. I know it's a day at a time, but I thought if I'm asked to do any, I've always tried to do this anyway, but especially this year, if I'm asked to do anything in the fellowship, I'll do it. And this was one of the things. And it was funny how it happened, because somebody contacted me months ago, and then that was it. And I hadn't heard anything until quite recently. But anyway, I'm here, and it's great, and came with an AA friend, and that's really good. I love the, was it Tom just now?
Yes.
Share? It's a lovely share. That was his first share. Could have fooled me. It was really powerful. Very, very lovely. Yeah, I grew up in South London, Croydon, and, you know, 1969, I call that the Great Intervention, because I left school at 15. So in that 6 years, I... my drinking was quite, my alcoholism was quite kind of rapid, really. And by the time I was 21, I'd had over 60 jobs. Now, this was the 60s, but there were still a lot of jobs. And I'd become unemployable. I'd been involved in the criminal justice system, not as a professional, but as a, as a participant. And I never came from, I was adopted, I was the only child, but my mum and dad, bless them, you know, they were good people, you know, they were wonderful. My mum and dad, but they certainly had never seen a prison. You know, I didn't come from a criminal subculture, but, you know, drink-related stuff. I wasn't good at being that bad. Crazy offences, ended up being on probation for 2 years. I even went to prison for non-payment of fine for about a month. And but the thing is, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, every other person seemed to have been... They used to say, you know, alcohol took me to prison, you know, for years. So not to be outdone, when I came in, I said, well, alcohol took me to prison. But I never told them it was a month. But it was long enough for me, you know, because my mum killed me with kindness, and I was 19, and it was a real culture shock to land up in Brixton Prison. But things were drastic, really. And but what worst of all, it was an all-time low in, when was it? In 1969, actually. I moved with them. They retired to a mobile caravan site near Sevenoaks. And I couldn't get any benefit. I was incapable of working. I was a mess, really. So I started diluting surgical spirit, which I'd done once with an alcoholic friend of mine. But that was just a one-off. But this became regular, because I could buy this stuff a lot cheaper than commercial alcohol, you know. And I rationalised it and think, well, it's pure. It's not contaminated with all that stuff they use in manufacturing, you know, alcohol for the shops. But, you know, I was using it every morning, diluting it, and sometimes, you know, more than once a day. And it was a wretched time. It really was. And it went on for about 10 months. And one morning I woke up and I thought, I need to disclose. I need to tell someone this. It was, always say it wasn't enhancing my well-being. And I walked down the 5 miles to the doctor's surgery. I went in to the receptionist and she said, "Who do you want to see?" And I said, "That one." And I pointed to a doctor's name, Dr. Campbell, Scottish man. I walked in there. And I just told him, I said, "Look, Doc, I've got to tell someone I'm drinking Surge." I said, "Occasionally meth when I can't get the Surge." And there was a terrible silence. And just to break the ice, I said, "But I'm diluting it." Half expecting him to say, "All right, laddie, we'll carry on with the orange juice." But he didn't. He looked at me in a very stern Scottish way and he said, "Have you been to Alcoholics Anonymous?" I said, "Alcoholics Anonymous?" I said, "Good God, man." I said, "I'm not that bad." He said, "Well..." He said, "Let me tell you a story." And he told the story of Big John M, who was his colleague and friend. And Big John M was this old-timer in Sevenoaks, over 25 years sober. And then after he told me the story, he 12-stepped me, really, by proxy. And then he made me, he said, "Right, phone Redcliffe Gardens." And I phoned Redcliffe Gardens. And there was a man in my caravan that evening called Gordon, who shared his experience, strength and hope with me. And he took me to my first meeting. And, you know, it was 1969, Sevenoaks group. And thank God, and I call that the great intervention because it was another 7 years before I stopped drinking. But, you know, if I hadn't have engaged with AA at that time, I don't know, I don't think I would have lived, actually. Things were getting very drastic. The next 7 years was spent in and out of two hospitals, Orpington General, because I was always prescribed other prescription drugs. I had an addiction with those as well. So I used to overdose, be taken to the hospital, go on to the psychiatric hospital, where AA members would come and visit me and take me out. And one of them is called Danny M, a man from Belfast. There was a man called Archie who died a couple of years ago in London. And Archie and Danny, Archie was over 50 years. Danny's living, he's alive still, Archie died. Danny lives on the south coast. He's over 50 years sober. And they had the same sponsor in Belfast, who was called Belfast Archie. But this man called Danny was an amazing man. I always say it's principles before personalities, but not instead of, you know, because we're all personalities, really, in our own way. And Danny was great. He'd come and visit me time and time and time again, take me out to meetings. Always in those days, I smoked cigarettes, so he'd always leave me some cigarettes. With a 10-shilling note in. I'm going back a bit. So I had some money. Bless him. And but, you know, he knew... It's funny, he knew the program inside out. He knew the people. He was, and he'd helped thousands of people. And he was just a lovely, lovely man. And, yeah, big impact on my recovery. Anyway, this went on. And when I was 25 years old, my mum died. And then 6 months later, my dad died. I don't remember much about the next 18 months. It was quite a blur. But I woke up in a hospital room in Orpington General, once again, in intensive care. Well, I was out of intensive care in this side room, and I had quite a profound experience. You know, for the first time in my life, I had the moments of sanity. I just burnt right down to the ground. I could not go on anymore. And it was as though I saw my life on the wall in a kind of movie, you know, and I saw every... I always remember this because, you know, when I'm trying to carry the message, no words are ever wasted. Because, you know, when the time is right, the person hears. And that was true for me because I saw and heard every person from my friends, my family, professionals who nicked me and all the rest of it, you know. I heard their message, you know, "Jim, you've got a drink problem." And that was October the 27th, 1976. And then I went on to a magnificent place called Pinnell House. We passed where it was today, driving out. I live in Beckenham now, and picked my friend up at East Croydon. We drived out through Warlingham onto the M25. The only thing that's left of the hospital and the grounds is the clock tower, because it's all private houses now. But that was a magnificent place, and it was started by Dr. Max Glatt in 1952. Max was a pioneer in the field of alcoholism. He was a little bit before his time, though, just a bit, because he went to the World Health Organization in 1951, they pronounced alcoholism a disease. And he came back and informed the government of this at the time. But he was about 60 years too early. They didn't really embrace it. But Pinnell House was to was to help thousands of people over the years. It closed in 1994 with the coming of Care in the Community. Whatever that is, sorry. Yeah, a little dig in there. But I went in there in 1976, and my consultant psychiatrist was a man called Dr. J.J. Gayford. And he was a remarkable man. He stayed there for 25 years. And last year, I was sitting in a church in East Grinstead in Sussex with Father Gayford, as he now is, an Anglican priest, next to me. And I was interviewing him for a magazine. And that was like, I've just typed it up, actually, to appear in this magazine. And that was one of the most amazing experiences of my life, because this man was like a god, you know, and there I was, a patient, you know, kind of 27 years old, 26 years old. And here I am now, well, 67 years old, and sitting with him. And he's a remarkable man. He's like 78. He's still a football referee. He's still a football referee at 78. Because I asked him towards the end of an interview, I said, oh, by the way, Father Gayford, because he said, oh, forget the doctor. He said, I'm not even registered now. That was then. He's just, forget that. But he was the most amazing man. He said, actually, I'm in my 61st season. I've got a match tomorrow. 78, what a role model. Blimey. But anyway, coming into Alcoholics Anonymous in that area, it was very strong at the time, a bit like Beaconsfield, you know, it was that kind of AA there, and there were lots of old-timers, people like Ironing Board Arthur, who I was later to meet and get to know quite well and like drive him around to meetings. There was an amazing old character called Higher Power Michael, or Mick the Quiff. Now, if any of you, yeah, I can see a nodding head. He was amazing. He said, well, I've got a cup of tea, it's much better than alcohol. And you know, and he was really spent 15 years locked up and 20 years. He was like a walking miracle, this guy. And I thought, wow. And one day, I was about 4 or 5 years sober. I just learned to drive and got my driving test. And he said, Jimmy, said, I got a chair. He said, I got a chair in Hastings. Could you give us a lift? And I said, yeah, all right, Michael. I thought, wow, what a privilege. Like an AA, like guru, you know, I'm taking him to Hastings. And I was so naive in those days, and I thought people like that were so spiritual, they didn't get angry at all. You know, I thought that was what sobriety was, you know, how we do. People are above all that, you know. Anyway, we went down, there were three of us, my friend, and then Michael was in the back. And it was pretty obvious, we were kind of outside of Hastings, that it was getting late. And he was getting really kind of stressed. And he was shouting and saying, and I thought, oh, Michael, how can this be? The man was 44 years sober. I thought you didn't get angry. I'm thinking all this. But that was a kind of, it was a great realisation that, you know, no matter how long we are sober, you know, we're still human. The monkey's off my back, but the circus is still in town, folks. You know, but it was great, kind of, those old guys, they helped me so much. Mick the Tick, Mick the Van. I kind of met all these people, but I got to know Mick the Quiff really well, and Ironing Board Arthur. But he was a real amazing man. I don't know if you know why he was called Ironing Board Arthur. There's various stories, but the actual story is that he was hospitalised in the Maudsley many times for his drinking. And on one occasion, he was the occupational therapist came round, and he was a very blunt man with a South London accent. He said, yeah, she came round and said, Arthur, do you want to make anything in occupational therapy? And I said, what do you mean, make anything? He said, well, is there anything you need? He said, oh, I don't know. He said, well, I need an ironing board. And she said, apparently the OT said, all right, Arthur, I'll help you make an ironing board. So I made this ironing board. And apparently his first chair was a blow-by-blow account of how he made this ironing board in the Maudsley. But he was a real character. He was a friend of mine was at a step meeting, and the friend had a sponsee, and it was on step five, let's say. And after the meeting, the sponsee said to my friend, hey, he said, Peter, he never spoke about the step. And my friend said, no, well, he's ironing board Arthur. I mean, I know, I said, but there were characters like that. But, you know, that man was, he walked, like in the 60s, he used to walk miles to meetings. Just used to walk to meetings across London and that. I mean, when I came in, I still got my first Where to Find, and it was 1977, AA Where to Find, London edition. And every day there was 11 meetings in the whole of London. That's in 1977. even then, you know, how it's grown now. We've got what? Well, we've got 800, I think. You know, it's amazing how things have changed. You know, but well, what can I say? I mean, you know, to sum up, it's just been amazing, really. It's been absolutely amazing. I love nostalgia. I love the history of the fellowship. My sponsor, who I had my sponsor for 25 years, his name was Sean Brown. He got sober in America, in New York. And he met Bill Wilson 3 or 4 times. And I never forget, I was sharing this to an archivist in Guildford, because they're mad on our, you know, archives and that. And I said my sponsor had met Bill Wilson. He said, "Did your sponsor meet Bill Wilson?" I said, "Yeah, he did, 3 or 4 times." He said, "Did you ever shake hands with your sponsor?" I said, "Yeah, of course I did, many times. We even hugged." And he said, "Okay." He said, "Can I shake your hand?" I said, "Yeah." And then he said, you know what he said, "I've shaken the hand of the man who shook the hand. He shook the hand of Bill Wilson." But in a way, that's kind of nice. It just shows you, in a sense, how new this fellowship is to the whole of civilization, you know, in historic terms. And so, yeah, you know, it's good. I've had a great, I mean, I had no life as a suffering alcoholic. I was young, but I had nothing to lose, really, except for my soul. And that's no material. I never qualified in anything. I had a budding music career when I was 17. I auditioned for Cat Stevens, but I can't remember much about it. I failed miserably. And there was one other audition, but that just kind of evaporated into addiction. But that's been one of the things I do now. I'm a musician and social worker, qualified in the 90s. And I do a lot of different diverse things, and it's been quite magnificent. My favourite thing is being a parent. I'm a sober dad. I've got 3 daughters, 4 grandchildren. I saw 2 of my daughters yesterday. I'm divorced, but good friends with my ex-wife. That's been amazing. It still is. It still is. I want to share this because our dreams and our dreams can come true, and our biggest fears can be surmounted. Because you know, if we, as somebody said just now, do the right thing, you know, do the steps, try and live a life along spiritual lines. I never flew for 51 years of my life. I'm only 67 now. Yeah, only 67. Well, I am. 60 is a new 40, so really, I'm only 47. I like that bit of denial, but I like it. I never flew for 51 years of my life because all my friends died in an air crash in 1958. Kids I played with, it was a school trip, and the plane crashed into a mountain in Stavanger, Norway. However, over the years, you know, didn't get around much. You don't, if you don't fly, do you? You don't really see much of life. And my marriage had finished, and I kind of went back to work as a care manager. You know, substance misuse. And I went down to Providence Rehab, that was down on the coast in Bournemouth, still is, I think. Got speaking to the guy who runs it. And on the way back, I was just about to leave. He said, "Jim," he said, he was in recovery. He said, "Look, listen to this guy's story. It's great, you'll love it. It's a man from Los Angeles called Earl." So I've just got my Sony Walkman that week, so I'm listening to this cassette of this man's story. This man was on a plane, the plane crashed. This was when he was drinking, and he lost his family. He survived. And then he went on to say, "Look," he said, "I don't really like flying. My family died on the crash. But when I'm asked to fly in Alcoholics Anonymous, I fly." I thought, gee, what an amazing man. How can he do this? 2 days later, a friend of mine said, "Look, there's a convention down in Bournemouth. Do you want to come?" I said, "Yeah." So I went down there, went in the hotel, looked at the list of speakers. You've guessed it. He was there. He was there. I spent a few minutes with him, 5-10 minutes, having a coffee, sharing. Did another few things. I was flying. Yeah, 51 years old, I started flying. And that really opened up my life, you know, because I'd always wanted to go to America. I'd always wanted to go. And I went. And I've been there a few times now. And I won a wonderful thing, an award called the Winston Churchill Travel Fellowship, because I do like a music and story session around treatment centres. And they gave me lots of money to go over there for 2 months and travel around, and, you know. And it was amazing. I met some amazing characters there. Talk about old timers. I stayed at a place called Veritas Villas. It's in upstate New York. It means House of Truth. Talk about hardcore. You drive into the kind of rehab and all the grounds, and it's got a sign there in red this is a tobacco-free facility. Yeah. If you smoke, you don't smoke and have treatment. Either. But there's two people, magnificent people. I've never met them before, but they treated me like a son. They were amazing, called Jim and Suzanne Cusack. And Jim celebrates his 64th anniversary this year. He's 86. Suzanne, his wife, is she's 43 years sober. And together they've treated thousands of alcoholics over the years. In fact, it's what they call a blue-collar treatment centre. A lot of cops go there and firemen. And they had quite a tribute there to all the people, the ex-patients who'd died in the Twin Towers, you know. But it was wonderful. It really was wonderful spending time with them. And right at the end, you know, as I say, they treated me like a son and I did my music there and everything. And when it came for me to go, Jim, this big old Irish-American guy, you know, 60-something years sober, he said, put his hand on my shoulder and he said, Jim, he said, everything's going to be okay in the end. I said, yeah, yeah. And he said, if it ain't okay, it ain't the end. And I looked at him and I thought, this guy knows, you know, because you don't keep sober for over 60 years without knowing. And it's true. It's so true. There's always, yeah, life can be difficult. Because I remember asking my sponsor in the early days, I said, you know, what's life? He said, well, look, Jim, if you meet someone in the rooms and they tell you life is all right all the time, I said, yeah, yeah. He said, don't accept a lift home in their car. And I said, why not, Sean? He said, because they'll lie to you again. I said, oh. I was like, we're naive, aren't we? We don't know. I said, why, isn't life all right all the time? And he said, well, not really. He said, there's kind of pain and suffering and difficult things. And of course there is. I've lost good friends. I've been ill. I've lost, you know, yeah. However, somehow, you know, that kind of piles into insignificance when I look back in the last 40 years, you know, because I've had magnificent times. And just driving out today with a friend who, you know, is fairly new in the program, just takes me back to when I, you know, came over here for conventions and I was a newcomer. And I used to, it was awesome, you know, hearing people who were a long time sober, well, longer than me, you know, whatever that was. And meeting new people and getting numbers and it just goes on and on, doesn't it? And, you know, service has been a big part of my recovery. You know, I was a delegate to conference in the 80s and that was overwhelming. I mean, really, when I look back, you know, I was so kind of ill-equipped, so just a few years sober, and some of these people I met from all over the country, you know, just incredible. But, I don't know, really. It's it's been a magnificent life, and it still is. You know, it's I'm coming up to my 68th birthday, and I've just got my first album. I still call it album. You know, I grew up in the 60s, of my own music. It's just kind of, I picked up the copies the other day. So there's a lot, and I started a new. Well, it's like a mini career. It's not a career, but it's like a little mini thing as a voiceover artist. I've done two jobs. And that's really good. I wish I'd have known about this 4 years ago. Wow, you know, it's pretty easy money, I tell you that. No, it's not as easy as it seems, but just, it's lovely to do these little things and, you know, diversify. I've always kind of enjoyed that, you know, just. And it's all thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous and the people in it, and especially the old-timers who really took me under their wing when I look back, because I had no mother, father, you know, I was just on my own, you know, and I was like 26 years old when I started out, going on about five. I didn't know about life, I'd never lived on my own, you know, got into my bed. I used to, you know, I went to Pinot House for 4 months, and I went 15 months in a halfway house, a hostel, and then I moved out into a bedsit, and I'd never, ever lived on my own, and I was nearly 27 years old. And some nights I used to listen to these AA tapes, like Chuck C, you know, from Laguna Beach, California. And they were inspiring, Jack Brennan and all these, you know, guys. And I used to cry myself to sleep sometimes, full of fear, full of neurosis, thinking, oh, I'd love to see these guys, but I never go because I don't fly. Never go because I don't fly. Well, as I just said, when I was 51, I flew, I started flying. And at the end of the Churchill Fellowship, I was in Palm Desert, which is in California. I was doing some work at the Betty Ford Clinic. And there was some meetings around there that I'd heard that you know, years ago Chuck C used to go to. And so I thought, right, I'm going to one. One morning I got up really early. It was a 6 o'clock meeting. about 250 people there, and there was a big kind of podium, you know. And the guy said, "Well, it's open. Someone get up and start the meeting." And I thought, right, I said a little prayer because it was a bit, you know, got up. I said, "Hi, I'm Jim, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm in America." And I, you know, I told them the story of the bedsit and that all those years ago. And there I was there. Dreams can come true. Not can, they do come true. And the biggest dream I ever had, I had it many, many times. It was a hope, a wish, a dream, an aspiration. I just wanted to be sober, just like the other people in the meetings. And when I was locked up in the mental hospital, I was sectioned four times. So I pray, I say, that's all I want. That was my biggest dream. And it was given to me. It was given to me on that day in 1976, you know. And I'm here today. And it's still my biggest dream. And I've been given that today. So thank you. Thank you for asking me to share here. And that's all, folks.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks, Jim. Yeah, just to that was amazing about catching taking a flight, and it is amazing what we can do, can't we? My son was involved in a train crash, the one at Thatcham here. It just reminded me. I haven't thought about it for ages. He was all right, but it's amazing how it plays in your mind. And I mean, I do catch trains, it never leaves me. That it can happen about with, but being sober, we can, you know, we can do it, and we know we've got. But that was wonderful. I'm so jealous. I've lived in America for quite a while, but drinking, I haven't been back sober. I don't think, I haven't. So I'd love to go to meetings in America. So that was great to hear about that. But yeah, that's brilliant. So thank you.
Thank you
very much.
Okay.
I'll go back. I thought that
it's
was
like the TV,
case.
Isn't it?
When yeah. It's just so good. At, we're kind of like a bit early for lunch.
Oh, right, okay.
And Tom, so could you talk for a bit more?
Because it was really
lovely to hear you.
I mean, if you ask, if you ask an alcoholic to talk a bit more,
I was going to nudge you. And
how long have you got?
So but you've got till maybe 12:30, even longer.
Well, yeah, but maybe it'd be a good thing to, you know, to throw it open a bit as well and get people to share. That's always a lovely thing. But I just
want old-timers' stories. That's
but I wouldn't mind. You know, the experience of going to America was quite profound because it's not different. I mean, it's the program, but it's so. I just found them so enthusiastic, you know, and passionate, which are two qualities I've always lacked in with people, you know, generally, but especially in recovery. I mean, one morning I it was very hot in New York where I was staying, and I woke up at 3:30 in the morning. And on my bed was a big meeting list, you know, about 5,000 meetings. So I was kind of looking through this, and I noticed there was a midnight group a few blocks from where I was staying. I thought, right, so I put my clothes on. I sallied forth to the meeting, and I had this little door with lots of graffiti on, and I pushed it open. And as I walked up the stairs, I heard all these voices, you know. And I walked in, and there were about 50 people there. There was a coffee bar. And somebody shouted over, "Hey man, where are you from?" Now, actually, from Beckenham, but you don't say that, do you? Because no one would know. So I said, "London." And they said, and then the same guy said, "How much time have you got?" I said, 26 years. He said, and he threw me a black t-shirt over with the midnight group in white. He said, "Well, put the shirt on, Jim, and give us your story. This is like 4 o'clock in the morning, you know?" And I'm 26 years sober. I thought, wow. I said, all right then. Took my t-shirt off, put their t-shirt on, and went up, gave a little share, and people came up. There were all kinds of people there and gave me like gifts, books, and it was really amazing, you know, just very unorthodox and fantastic. And one morning I did a share at Perry Street, which is a famous old meeting in Greenwich Village. It goes back to the early days, you know, the late 30s. Bill and Bob. And the next morning I was in like the high street, I suppose, where I was staying, And there was a group of young people. I mean, they were very young, like 16, 17, you know, teenagers. And one of them shouted out, "Hey, it's Jim." And I looked up and I said, "Hey, Jim, how are you, man? We saw you at Perry Street." I said, "Yeah, I'm good, guys." And they all came over, about seven of them. They said, "Can we buy you breakfast?" I said, "Well, yeah." And these young people took me for breakfast. And they just asked me about London and AA. And they were like so, what's the word? They were so thirsty, hungry for recovery. Oh, I loved all that, you know. But, yeah. Actually, an interesting point about the historical things. I was born in 1948. And 1948 was the year that AA came into this country. And it was Grace O., a lady from America who's on a, I think she was on a trip or something around the world, whatever, but she was in recovery in AA, and she had a room at the Dorchester, and she advertised, I don't know, probably in the Times somewhere, she said, you know, recovering alcoholic, and there'd be a meeting in my room, and people showed up, and that was the first, first AA meeting in the UK, you know, yeah. And I remember it was quite interesting because when I got involved in service, intergroup, and then, well, it wasn't called region in those days. It was, what was it called? Well, it wasn't. We didn't, well, I was chairman of South London Intergroup, which actually went from Reigate in Surrey all the way down to Brixton, which is one hell of an area, you know, yeah. And then, you know, I went to conference and they spoke about regionalisation, and this was a whole new thing, which obviously moved the fellowship forward, you know, in communication and that. So, but I went up with it. Travelled up to the conference with a guy called Leslie C. And he came in the 50s. He was involved in the big London, just called a London intergroup. And it was kind of the very early days, really. I'm just trying to think of other old-timers I know over the years. Good heavens. So. Wow. No, Arthur was a real character. Oh, yes, there was off-licence Brendan. He was quite an amazing man. When he died, he was 47 years sober, I think, Brendan. But he was a manager of an off-licence in Wallington, just outside Croydon. And when we had all the kind of AA conventions and there was a dance, Brendan would, in those days, because it was Al-Anon and AA, yeah, but, you know, friends as well would come of the alcoholics and the Al-Anons, there would be alcohol served, actually, at the bar. And, yeah, and of course, Brendan used to supply that. But, you know, hey, that's okay. I mean, yeah. I remember him. He was a great old guy. There was a man called Little Phil, and another lovely Irishman, South London. He was very spiritual and just very. Yeah, there was just. Yeah, and of course there were people that, you know, came and went, as you all know over the years. We, you know, people come in, don't they? Sometimes stay a while and then leave, and you never hear of them. Then sometimes they come back, which is great, get sobriety. Wow. I always said that, you know, we in the fellowship, I know for me, I'm very fortunate because we get to know so many people, which is a wonderful experience. However, there's another side of that. We tend to lose a lot of people, you know, more than the average person, if you like, you know, and a lot of AA funerals over the years. But hey, you know, it's just for today, isn't it? Just for today. I remember this is interesting, historically. My first ever convention was in, I think, February 1977. It's a few months. I was several months in recovery. And I was just going up to telephone service as a kind of extra member. And I got to know a lady called Mari, who was the manager, the manager of the telephone service. And she was a lovely lady. Sadly, she smoked too much, bless her, I was always. But she was married to Trevor O, who was also an old timer then, you know. And I really got to like them, they were nice. They, and she phoned me up. She could be quite official, said James, and she was the only person who called me James since I left school, you know, my mum, teachers did. She said, James, what are you doing at the weekend? I said, oh, nothing much, Mari. She said, would you like to come down to Canberra Convention with us? I said, oh, yeah. I was overawed, really. I was a bit frightened because, you know, I thought, wow, these two old, they're like AA kind of dignitaries almost. I was still just thinking like that. Anyway, they picked me up in Croydon and they had a beautiful Labrador puppy. This little puppy was only about 4 months old, but they had to give it Valium for the trip because it was a bit, you know, energy. For some reason, they gave it Valium, which is was no stranger to me. But there I was in the back with this Valiumized Labrador on my lap. But it was a wonderful journey because we drove down to Canberra. And I realised on that trip, just because I was, they were like years in recovery and they were the same as me. They were just sharing stuff, you know, just, yeah. So it was a great realisation. And when we got there, I never forget, it was called The Joy of Living, the Canberra Convention. It had a big smiley face, which later the Acid House music lot kind of railroaded. They took the little logo of the smiley face. But it actually first appeared, well, as far as I'm concerned, in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we parked the car and we kind of said, all right. She said, well, look, you go and mingle and we'll meet at lunchtime, you know. So I walked in and I must have been around, I don't know. It was kind of 9 or 10 months maybe. It was, you know, I wasn't a year sober. But I walked in there and the amount of people that came up to me, it was totally overwhelming. Jim, great to see you. Didn't know you'd be coming down here. And these were all people I'd met, you know, at the meetings since I was at the rehab and or left the rehab. And I was just overcome with the kindness and love. And I had to go out of the, you know, conference hall. And I went out, kind of outside, and just cried, but tears of happiness and joy. You know, which was a change. So I'll never forget that. That was quite amazing. It really was. Yeah. Anyway, I've rambled on. What about you? You want more, do you? Oh.
Just while they're getting lunch sorted.
Just getting lunch, yeah. Yeah.
5 more minutes.
Okay, yeah. One interesting thing, well, it's fascinating, really, that, I mean, Tom alluded to this. I had incredible low self-worth. I think sometimes we have no self-worth. What about low? I don't think it was there at all. And I certainly couldn't share. You might find this hard to believe. But it took me about 18 months, 2 years to actually share at a meeting. You know, I don't mean from top table, just, yeah, it really did. I had no communication skills whatsoever, no interpersonal skills, couldn't even spell them, certainly didn't know what they meant. But what actually happened? I was asked to do things in Alcoholics Anonymous step by step. And I wanted to because I wanted to put something back. So when I was, you know, like made, you know, whatever it was, public information liaison officer or whatever it was, I was going out in the community, meeting people, relating, all this stuff, you know, chairman of South London Inter Group. I was kind of being a chairperson, listening to that side and that side. And all the time, being known to me, I was learning life, what they call life skills. I was learning all this. And then much later, you know, when I qualified as a social worker, I was taking meetings and dealing with professionals, blah, blah. But I've never forgot where I've come from. And I thought, yeah, you know, I'm sitting here chairing this meeting. It's all thanks to AA. Gave me all those skills. It's not often shared about, but it gave me all those living skills, those life skills, communication skills. Unbelievable. And yeah, and I've been able to carry the message, you know, because I say I've done a lot of, I've been a care manager in lots of London boroughs and I've done lots of work in, you know, in social work, and I've been able to share about Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I find it, you know, I'm going back quite a time now, but even now, I don't think things have changed that much. They have changed, which is great. But I was working for a team of people, like in Croydon for 4 years, And the budget was quite a lot of money each year. You know, lots of money, hundreds of thousands of pounds. And my manager, who no one else was in recovery, he was a care manager, I said to her one day, I said, do you realise that 99% of the rehabs we fund clients to go to, I said, do you realise they operate on a 12-step programme, you know, from Alcoholics Anonymous? They're modified, but they... And the AA is a way of life for aftercare, for, you know. I said, no, didn't really know that. And you think, good grief, what other area of life or medicine would a consultant say, well, I'm going to pay, you know, a few hundred thousand pounds for your treatment, but I don't really know much about it. You wouldn't get it, would you? Because most consultant specialists know a lot about what they fund for. But somehow the field of alcoholism, it's a bit ambiguous. And I gave them a workshop. I got a kind of little workshop together, the 12 steps for professionals, and I kind of did that a few times. So I've had a good opportunity in my working life, not now so much, but I do other things, but to carry the message of this wonderful fellowship to professionals. Because after all, you know, if it wasn't for a professional, the message was carried to me by this GP. That's how I got to know about Alcoholics Anonymous. So, I don't know what would have happened if that day hadn't happened. I mean, who knows? So that's been an important part of my recovery as well. So, there we are. I believe I'm drying up.
You do.
I don't think I've said that for a long time. Gee, I'm drying up. No. But when I use that phrase, I'll finish with this because this is a lovely story. When I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, he was never my sponsor. But you know, sometimes we have relationships, friendships with people in the fellowship that they're not formally our sponsor, but sometimes, hey, they're even more. It's a spiritual advisor, call them what you will. Well, I picked up on this guy. He was called Len B. He was an old-timer in Croydon. And he had this amazing accent. I mean, I'm no Rory Bremner, but I could actually impersonate him to a T. He used to say, this disease is coming baffling and powerful. That's how he used to say, you know. And one night, because people knew that I used to impersonate him, and one night I was at a meeting, and my friend said, good, do a Len B, Jim. I said, all right. Cunning, baffling, and powerful. Anyway, I felt a hand on my shoulder. He was behind me. He said, yes, very fucking good, Jim. He said, don't let me catch you do that again. But he smiled and he said, that was a good impersonation, I must say. Anyway, he was a lovely man because in his latter years, he wasn't that mobile, you know. And he used to give me a ring or we'd meet at a meeting. He said, oh, you're a lad, Jim. You get up to the smoke, didn't you? Getting all these meetings, he said. Come out with these sayings. He said, what have you got for me this week, Jim? Come on, give me one. He was like nearly 80. I say, well, then, I heard this great saying the other day. The alcoholic lives in an overcrowded universe of one. And he went, oh, blimey. He said, that's beautiful. He said, oh, you're a boy. He said, anyway, he got ill. He got ill. And he got pretty ill. And he got pretty ill just about the time I told you about I met that guy and I took a flight to America. In fact, I took the flight to New York and Len had died a couple of days prior to that, which was just one of those things. But anyway, I kind of dealt with it spiritually. And I went, my first meeting was in Brooklyn in America. And I was with my friend and it was in a church where Al Capone was baptized. Nice bit of history for you. And it was a big meeting, and this guy said, hi, I'm Bob, I'm an alcoholic. And they went, hi, Bob. And he said, hi, everyone. He said, the monkey's off my back, but the circus is still in town. And I swear to God, Len had been dead 2 days. I looked up, and I saw his beaming face in the sky. He looked down on me, he said, God, Jim, he said, that was worth the plane fare just for that one. It's a gem. And, you know, it was, wasn't it? The monkey's on my back, but the circus is still in town. And it's very much in town sometimes. There is progress. Of course there is. I've got a lot better. But I still need this program. every day, and I want it for the rest of my life. But more important, yeah, rather than need, I want it, because there's people like you and that I've met that has enhanced my life and a God of my very own. So now I will stop.
Well, you've done brilliantly. Thank you very much. And I was reminded those last 15 minutes. That was fascinating, and it reminded me of what you said earlier, which I loved. I haven't heard that before. Mm. No words are ever wasted when passing the message. Mm. And it's so true. And that's brilliant, because my daughter's now in recovery, actually, but she often talks about when she wasn't, last year. Mm. And I don't have the same, obviously we're two different people, so two different truths,
yeah, of course.
But I don't have the same story about it as she does. But what's wonderful is her story is how kind and loving I was.
Yeah.
You know, that now that might be because she's my daughter, but I don't think so. What I think has happened is, obviously I had moments of being down, but I was trying to be encouraging.
Sure.
And I was trying to find meetings, and I was trying to find people to talk to. But I don't really remember that. I only remember the bad times.
That's right, yeah.
So that was brilliant, because I can now see maybe where, those words were not wasted. And the trying to find help, because amazingly, day at a time, she's now in recovery, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
So really lovely, thank you. And thank you for being a sport with the extras.
Thank you.
With the extra, because we just, but I'll, it's great, so thank you.
Thank you.
And I